Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a weekly public affairs radio program produced by campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. The show is podcast at globalresearch.ca and airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. This week, as part of our 2017 summer series, we air audio from a talk by Ava Bartlett entitled "What Really Is Going On in Syria." This talk was presented in Winnipeg's Millennium Library on February 2, 2017. It was part of a Canadian multi-city tour conducted in late 2016 and early 2017, co-sponsored by the Canadian Peace Conference and the Syria Solidarity Movement. Winnipeg sponsors of the event included the Manitoba Peace Council, Canadian Dimension Magazine, and CKUW 95.9 FM, which hosts the Global Research News Hour radio program. Ava Bartlett is an independent Canadian journalist from Fergus, Ontario, who has visited Syria and covered the war there on six separate occasions since 2014, including 2 months in the summer of 2016 and 1 month at the end of 2016. She writes for and speaks on different media outlets, but always maintains her blog in gaza.wordpress.com, which she started some years ago while living for a period of 3 years in Gaza. Bartlett started to receive a lot of attention on the internet after a video of her presenting at a December 9, 2016 UN press conference went viral. She exposed in a very compelling way the mainstream and even a lot of alternative media myths and lies being told about the ongoing conflict in the Western Asian country. Bartlett's first-hand reporting, like that of her colleague Vanessa Beely, challenges the narratives put forward not only by mainstream media, but also alternative outlets like Democracy Now! And human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Médecins Sans Frontières. Her journalism points to the reality that it is principally the foreign insurgents like the Al-Nusra Front and ISIS, and not the Syrian government, that is the main arbiter of violence in the country. Contrary to the insinuation from critics of being an Assad supporter, she claims to support the sovereignty of the Syrian people, which has been undermined by the US and NATO, as well as the so-called rebels. The talk you are about to hear was recorded and edited by me, Michael Welch, for the Global Research News Hour. Ava Bartlett was introduced by Liz Carlisle, a local organizer, union member, and activist, who also functioned as the moderator of the event. So here is Ava Bartlett on the Global Research News Hour in the summer.
Eva is an independent writer and activist for human rights. She's got extensive experience in Syria and Gaza. In fact, she lived for a cumulative total of 3 years in Gaza from 2008 to 2013 and documented both the 2008, 2009, and 2012 war crimes by Israel against Gaza. She was riding in ambulances and reporting from hospitals at that time. So again, had a kind of firsthand and eyewitness experience that is not too common. Also, from June to August 2016, she visited Syria. She's visited Syria 6 times, in fact, I understand. Her writings can be found on her blog in Gaza. I believe that that blog does include work from Gaza as well as Syria. And it's a really good place to go to find out more about Eva's observations and her perspective. And without further ado, I'll introduce Ava Bartlett. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for both the introductions, and thank you all for having this forum where I can speak and share my experiences in Syria, what Syrians have told me, what they really ask and demanded people here to at least know about outside of Syria. Before I get into it, I just want to make a few remarks. Let's see. First of all, yes, I have been to Syria 6 times. The first time was with an international peace delegation, and our interest was exclusively and solely to go to Syria to meet with Syrian people. It was only for 1 week, and it was only in the cities of Damascus, Homs, and Latakia, but it was still very informative for the majority of the 40 or 50 plus people. And I also went on one other delegation led by former Attorney General Ramsey Clark and also by former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, and that was in February 2015. The other four visits, I've applied for a visa at the Syrian embassy in Beirut, and in three cases, I waited well over a month to get my visa permission, which I paid for, of course, the visa procedure, and then I paid for my own transit to Syria and travel within Syria and accommodation. So I think it's important to establish that I am self-funded and I've paid for my trips in Syria. Another note is that I'm sure you're all aware that independent media does not pay well, or pay, period. So, and this is not a solicitation for donations, I'm just making a point. I write for maybe three sites that actually pay me for my articles, and the rest of them don't. So the ones that pay are one called sutt.net, S-O-T-T.net, and it's, you know, covers a variety of issues, American Herald Tribune, which I've contributed to, and Russia Today, which I've contributed to. So on that note, I want to just show you a few things before I get into the whole thing. So Russia Today I started writing for when I was living in Gaza, and they approached me and they say, you know, we saw your blog, you're living there, we'd really like it if you could contribute opinion pieces. I stress this, opinion pieces. Has anyone heard of the op-ed section of the New York Times or any major paper? These are opinion pieces. Employees are people that write opinion pieces for New York Times, Toronto Star, wherever, are not employees of Toronto Star or New York Times. They're contributors too. So I note that from April 2013 to present day, I contributed 8 opinion pieces to RT. I also just want to make a quick note, and there's a reason I'm making these points, is because there are some articles written about me that say Bartlett writes a blog for Russian state-controlled media. They're referring, of course, to the opinion section of Russia Today. Now, the other thing I wanted to note, the other thing I want to note is this. Here are some authors who contribute to the opinion section of Russia Today. Some of these names might be familiar to you. Cynthia McKinney is one. You can see for yourself. But anyway, there's over 70 contributors. Mazi Nazimroya, who's been excellent, very detailed and articulate on Libya and other issues. And a number of other people. Sharmeen Narwani, who I highly recommend reading on Syria. William Engdahl. So you can see these are all employees of of Putin. Right. I think you got the point. The other thing I just want to note is look at this at the very bottom here. The statements, views, and opinions expressed in this column are solely those of the author and do not necessarily reflect those of RT. Thus, those who contribute to RT are doing so of their own will. What I write is not censored unless it's for flow or I have some typos, which definitely occur. But they are my sentiments. And I'm making this point. I'm not at all saying I'm an expert on Syria. I would never even pretend that. But what I'm saying is I'm going to share my observations from Syria and also draw in some, you know, conclusions based on also a lot of research looking at a variety of different sites. And I would encourage you to, after my presentation, definitely don't take my word for it. Do your own research. Find your own sources. See if my stories corroborate with other authors or reports. One author I would highly recommend is Stephen Gowans. He's a Canadian. And the reason I'm mentioning him, I'll just mention in Ottawa and in Montreal, and I had the honor to have Stephen Gowans, Michelle Chosudovsky, and also Eve Engler speak prior to my part of the panel. And with regard to both Gowans and Chosudovsky, they gave, you know, a terribly important context into what was happening in Syria prior to 2011, or also the NATO or the U.S., not just U.S., the NATO alliance waging wars on sovereign nations, and Syria not being the first, and also reminding of some of the media lies that we've heard before, whether it was incubator babies or Gaddafi's forces raping women, being on Viagra and raping women, or weapons of mass destruction, none of which any of these allegations ever had any substance behind them. And it does really surprise me when it comes to Syria, so many people somehow have forgotten the lessons we've learned from these prior wars of aggression on sovereign nations. Tim Anderson is another author I would like to recommend before I get into it. And just to quote him, He said many Western audiences, liberals and leftists, as well as the more conservative, seem to like the idea of their own role as saviors of a foreign people, speaking out strongly about a country of which they knew very little, but joining what seemed to be a good fight against this new dictator. With a mission in their proud self-image, Western audiences apparently forgot the lies of previous wars and of their own colonial legacies. And I read that, he goes on, and I'd like to also suggest, you know, if you're interested in some very genuine research, Tim Anderson has a book called The Dirty War on Syria, and in my opinion, it's an invaluable resource. I'd like to start with a short clip, and then I will explain it. So that's my own little editing job, taking a clip from the BBC, who has an expert of sorts asserting certain things about this video. And the video is called Syrian Hero Boy. It purported to show a little boy rescuing his sister from fire, which could have been coming from the Syrian army or from rebel militants. And so the expert says, you know, the video, we can't really say for sure whether it's accurate or not, but we can definitely say it's in Syria. And we can definitely say so because it has the colors of the Syrian army flag, how she stated. It's actually the flag of the country of Syria, painted on a barrel. So this is a still from that video. Please note the color scheme. And these are barrels that I took a photo of in Aleppo. Do you notice any differences? So based on these barrels with a similar color scheme, but a totally inaccurate one, this expert said we can definitely say it's in Syria and we can definitely say it's in a regime area. The video was produced by Norwegians and filmed in Malta. So just bear in mind, this is the BBC and this is not the first time they've been wrong or they've outright lied. She must have been mistaken. It happens. But, you know, for an expert to definitely say about the flag and then getting even that wrong is very telling. So again, just to stress, you know, really question your sources. The other one I'd like to show you briefly. This is one example where one would have to be extremely skeptical about this video, because had you not seen the frozen motion prior to the action beginning, and had you not seen this man posing with his rescuers after on, you know, crushed legs, you might actually believe this was a rescue scene. And so the point I'm trying to make is, whereas some of the videos might be true, some of them might be staged. And this shows how clearly possible it is to stage a very compelling rescue video. And the White Helmets, because I'll probably forget later to tell you, they are basically a group that purports to be neutral, unbiased Syrian rescuers, grassroots people, doing their bit for the community, saving civilians from regime or Russian bombings. This is basically paraphrasing. This is what their story is. And they've saved anywhere from 60 to 80,000. I think 80,000 was the latest figure I've seen in Syria. In reality, they were founded in 2013 by a British ex-military officer, James Le Mercier. They've been funded by the West with well over $100 million, so they're not exactly grassroots. They work exclusively in militant areas and more frequently in al-Qaeda, al-Nusra areas. And not all, but some of them definitely do participate in holding flags or weapons in alliance with al-Qaeda or other mercenaries in Syria. And you can see in this image, whereas you could say, well, that was before, and then they became rescuers. In this image, you actually see a White Helmet volunteer with al-Qaeda. So these people are not neutral, and they have actually participated in collecting the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers and gloating about it. They've also been on the scene at assassination sites. So this is from a video. Somebody compiled this collage showing within seconds after the man in the black jumpsuit was assassinated, White Helmets appeared. So again, implying not exactly neutral. Yet they're one of the main sources that we've been told by corporate media, especially by Channel 4, a UK channel, which incidentally wrote the piece about me saying I was a blogger for RT, they are one of the main sources that our media has been using. And Democracy Now!, which purports to be independent media, has been shameful on Syria just as they were with Libya. And they, you know, I gave up following them years ago because it just made me sick to my stomach. But I am aware that they've largely, by accounts of other people who've been more religious and following them, they've largely only had one side of the story, and they've actually hosted the filmmaker who made the documentary on the White Helmets. And the filmmakers themselves never even went to Syria. Nonetheless, Democracy Now! Has chosen to support that avenue. And another two sources that our media tells us are giving us the facts are the Aleppo Media Center. You'll see the AMC logo on many of the films and photos coming out of Aleppo or in the past. They are also funded by the West, which makes them not a partial source or an impartial source. And the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, SOHR, which is literally, this observatory is literally one man in the UK who flies an FSA flag on his website, who is vocally anti-government. So again, not an impartial source. And he himself relies on unnamed activists, the White Helmets, and characters who themselves are not impartial. These are the main sources, some of the main sources, that we've been getting, Western media has been getting their facts from regarding Syria. One last note before I get into it. In April of 2016, there were, in that month, there were a series of, it was like a flurry of media reporting on Aleppo, on hospitals being targeted and destroyed, on last doctors. There was a really concerted effort to move people to be compelled to support something like a no-fly zone, which they rebranded as a safe zone, thinking that sounded nicer. But in effect, it means destroying the country and allowing, you know, imposing a puppet government, which is what they did in Libya. Médecins Sans Frontières, you can see this tweet where they said a hospital, which was the Quds Hospital in the Al-Sukri district of Aleppo, was destroyed. In their actual report, they said it was hit, reducing it to rubble, so destroyed. This is the Al-Quds Hospital, still standing. A colleague of mine was in Aleppo in December, and she took this photo. And she also was able to enter the hospital and find paperwork showing it was operational as of July 2016, a few months after the April allegations. So again, this story was very compelling. People were outraged. The Syrian government or the Russian airplanes bombed this hospital. That was the story, and people were outraged and compelled to do something. The story was false. The hospital was not destroyed. But we never get these fact checks. So it's rather ironic that there's all this focus on fact checking when the main perpetrators of lies have been the fact checkers themselves. So on to Aleppo. When I was in Syria in summer 2016, I had been to many areas of Syria. I'd been to Homs a number of times. I'd been to Homs in June 2014, about one month, I think it was, after militants who had been occupying the old city of Homs were taken out in a deal similar to what's happened in Aleppo recently. They were bussed out, and they were given safe passage. Now, I just want you to really focus on this. They were given safe passage from the area they were occupying, essentially holding the people that remained in that area hostage, just like with Aleppo. They were given safe passage to, it might have been Idlib, some other part of Syria, where they joined other militants. I cannot imagine a context in America, in Canada, in which terrorists occupying one area of a city and literally terrorizing the public and killing the public would be given safe passage to somewhere else to terrorize the public elsewhere. I can't see that happening. In any case, as I was going to say, I'd been to many areas of Syria, but I hadn't been to Aleppo. And given that there were so many confusing stories coming out of Aleppo, I really wanted to go and see for myself what people were saying there. So this is the main, well, not the main road. This is the alternative road to Aleppo. It's called the Kanasser Highway. The main road goes through areas of Syria which are occupied by militant factions, so it's been off limits for years. This particular highway is not very wide. At this point, I believe it was, ISIS was less than 10 kilometers off to, it would have been the east. And at night, they come onto the highway and lay landmines. And they also wage attacks just randomly. You can see, as you're driving along, you can see the shells of different vehicles, trucks, on the sides, either side of the road, from attacks from ISIS. And I believe also in the past from al-Nusra. So it is a very dangerous highway, as was the sole road at that time leading into Aleppo, called the Ramusi Road. And that road was dangerous because militants in a district called Sheikh Said, just some hundreds of meters to the northeast of Ramusi, would snipe at people on the road, and they'd also shell the road. And bearing in mind that, yes, there are military in that area, but it was also the only transit point for civilians exiting and entering Aleppo, as well as transport trucks bringing in the vital goods that they needed. So there were earthen embankments and sniper shields. But that said, it didn't prevent these militants from sniping at people and killing people on this road. Another important point about Ramusi Road is that when, on many occasions, it was cut off, that meant the people in Greater Aleppo were completely besieged. And they had no means of getting vital supplies into Aleppo until that road was resecured. And I mention that because what I found when I went to Aleppo basically reaffirmed what I felt I thought I would find, and that was that when Western media was reporting about Aleppo, they meant East Aleppo. They didn't mean all of Aleppo. They meant one segment of Aleppo, and they meant the area that was occupied by militants or rebels, whatever you want to call them, and they meant only to focus on those areas and totally ignore the 1.5 million people in the rest of Aleppo and ignore their suffering. They'd been suffering since mid-2012. Not only from the difficulty getting in and out of the city and the periodic sieges depriving them of food supplies, but also a want of electricity and water because both the water pumping station and the power plant were in areas controlled by militants. So for years they've survived off of wells, over 300 wells that the government and volunteer associations dug, and buying electricity from generators. And of course, not everybody could afford to do that. And they would literally buy it by the ampere. So maybe one ampere could power a couple of bulbs, two amperes could power a couple of light bulbs and a small fridge, etc. And a lot of people couldn't afford that because the combination of now 6 years of war on Syria has devastated the economy, and the Western sanctions on the country have devastated the economy. So a lot of people simply couldn't afford to buy electricity. I got a taste of that when I returned to Aleppo in August and stayed in a district called Azizia. And the building I was in had been completely, all the residents had left and had immigrated to Europe or elsewhere because they couldn't take it anymore, living under the bombs of these rebel factions. And also, when I was there, that building had no electricity, no water. And as I looked out onto the block, the whole block was dark except for about 7 apartments, which had very dim light. So essentially, all the people that remained in that block couldn't afford to buy electricity. And this is an important factor. Obviously, you can imagine a life without electricity and water for years. So back to the issue of hospitals. One of the first things I did was to go to the Aleppo Medical Association because I kept seeing all these reports in Western media about last doctors and last pediatricians. And the Aleppo Medical Association has registered and active 4,160 doctors. And then I asked them to break down, you know, the specialist. And so the director, Dr. Zahra Batal, gave me a list. And so I tallied up the list of specialists, so again, pediatricians and other specialists. And there were around 800 specialists. And this is important because, again, when Western media or corporate media was talking about Aleppo, they were talking about East Aleppo, and they were saying last pediatrician, last doctor, anyway, last specialist. And that wasn't the case. The other thing about the situation for doctors and hospitals in Aleppo was that hospitals in Greater Aleppo have been attacked. And this is, to my knowledge, not reported in corporate media. This is one example. The Dabit Hospital in May 2013, it wasn't directly attacked the first time. The second time a week later it was, with a mortar landing on the roof. The first time a rocket or a missile of some sort fired by militant occupied areas landed on parked cars outside the hospital, exploding the cars, internally gutting the hospital, and killing 3 women inside. And with all the concern about hospitals that we heard, if you're following Syria, you would have thought that these kind of scenes would have been something we would have seen in New York Times. So you can see it was an immense explosion or series of explosions, depending on how many cars exploded. And again, a maternity hospital. That's just one example. A more notable example was al-Nusra truck bombing the Kindi Hospital, which was a massive cancer research hospital. And literally, there was no condemnation that I'm aware of from the West. I actually interviewed the director, the former director of the Kindi Hospital, Dr. Ibrahim Hadid, and he said when it was occupied by al-Nusra, he tried to contact the WHO and other bodies that would be concerned about, you know, healthcare in Syria, and was met with apathy and no condemnation. And he said it was the same when the hospital was destroyed, no condemnation. But another important point about the Kindi Hospital was that some months ago, I saw a photo of this destroyed Kindi Hospital being shown and being claimed to be in East Aleppo and being claimed that it was bombed or destroyed by the Russians or the Syrians. And this was something that occurred in 2013 by al-Nusra. So again, the media doesn't really expect us always to check our sources. or check the truth. So I interviewed a man named Dr. Nabil Antaki. He is on Facebook. Also, if you Google his name, Antaki, A-N-T-A-K-I, you can find a number of independent sources that have interviewed him. He's interesting. He's a very straightforward guy. He's not necessarily completely supportive of the government, but anyway, he was pointing out the greater issues that people are facing. And he said, since July 2012, the main area of Aleppo receives everyday mortars, bombs, and gas canisters. And I don't know if you noticed the gas canister photo I had at the beginning. They're basically cooking gas canisters that have been fitted with explosives and fired on a near daily basis, not only on Aleppo, but outskirts and other areas of Syria. He said, here you have human damage more than there, meaning East Aleppo, which may or may not be true. I'll get to that. But the important point he makes is here you have less physical destruction because the bombs they're receiving are of a small size but raining on a constant basis. So a mortar might make, according to him, a hole the size of a window but also kill five people at once. And if you imagine that on one particular day, you have over 100 mortars or a combination of mortars and missiles and other explosives, the human damage was immense. In fact, the head of forensics that I met with in November on my third visit to Aleppo said in the past 4+ years, 11,000 civilians, not including military personnel, just civilians in Aleppo have been killed by these different mortar, gas canister, explosive bullets and sniping attacks by militant factions. So that's a significant number, 11,000 civilians, yet not one that I've ever heard in Western media, because it doesn't support their narrative. Dr. Zahir Buttel, I was asking him just to give me some statistics. So he was referring to April, since that was a month that was heavily reported on, last doctors, last hospitals. And he said from April 23rd to 30th, there were 120 Aleppo residents killed and over 800 wounded by these different militant attacks. And later, when I was asking him some questions through message, he said between July 31st and August 15, another 143 civilians were killed, including 23 women and 54 children. So again, these are statistics, but it's to say the people were suffering on a daily basis from the combination of want of electricity, water, and terrorist attacks. And if you go there and you talk with them, they're very clear about it. They do call them terrorists. Even Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, Hawaiian congresswoman, she recently went to Syria and she made it to Aleppo and she talked with people and she came back saying what I'm saying. And she said, if you talk to Syrian people, they might call them rebels every now and then, but they definitely also say they're terrorists because these are acts of terrorism. Just on a side note, in terms of the notion of a revolution, which we can get into also in Q&A, just ask yourselves what kind of revolution consistently targets civilians. For example, this is a public park, the main public park in Aleppo. And I went there because in July there had been a rather nasty attack which left at least two women and a child dead as they sat on a park bench on a Friday afternoon. The number was much higher, but with regard to this one image, it is very graphic, I will warn you. It was on a bench like this, Friday afternoon in July, and these women and at least one child, you can see in the photo, were killed when a rebel fired some sort of rocket or missile into the park. And in my belief, this is not accidental. The targeting of public places is not accidental. It's what they've been doing throughout Syria. And yet, little to no condemnation from Western leadership and corporate media.
My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour on University of Winnipeg-based radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, and podcast at globalresearch.ca. Today, as part of our 2017 summer series, we're airing a talk by independent journalist Ava Bartlett on what is really going on in Syria. The talk was presented at Winnipeg's Millennium Library on February 2, 2017, roughly 2 months after her last visit to the country. The Global Research News Hour recorded the talk. Here is more from that discussion.
On November 3rd, I was there with a delegation of Western journalists, and on that day, a barrage of Grad missiles and then other mortars, gas canister bombs, and explosive bullets and snipings occurred throughout the day. By the end of the day, there were 18 killed and over 200 injured. And we were at the main hospital, Al-Razi, and also at the morgue behind. So this is just a short compilation of some of the things we were seeing there. So at the end of the clip, there's a man speaking. He's from Western Syria, Jizr al-Shughur, and he's talking about the loved ones, his mother and other loved ones that have died in attacks. And he does specifically say Irhabiyin terrorists. And he says that we want the army to finish them off. This is a theme that I've heard from many Syrians, anguished. You know, they've been suffering terrorism, and they say, just finish them off, just end our suffering. It doesn't mean that I agree with, you know, bombing entire areas and killing civilians, but I don't condemn this man. He's basically just in anguish, and he's saying, we want an end to our terrorism. And yet, as Tim Anderson pointed out, the government has, you know, contrary to certain media reports and contrary to human rights groups like MSF or Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, the latter two of which are tied very deeply to the State Department and receive funding from the U.S. government, hardly impartial, the army has been waging as strategic as possible operations to target the terrorist, and yes, civilians are being killed as well. But it's not policy to just go in and flatten out an entire area like the Israelis did in Shijai in Gaza in 2014. And in fact, speaking of Shijai, the head of Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth, tweeted video footage from Shijai and said, this is Aleppo under Assad's bombs. So this is, again, a source that we're told is going to give us credible reporting and on Syria. And he himself has tweeted many, many inaccurate things about Syria and seems to have a vested interest in regime change there. This is one of 16 Aleppo University residences which are housing internally displaced Syrians from eastern Aleppo and other areas occupied by militants or where there's fighting between the militants and the army. And for years, they've been housing. The numbers are somewhere between 10 and 15,000. And that's my estimate because we counted the number of rooms on each floor, estimated the number of people in each family. And the number is somewhere between 10 and 15,000, just in these residences alone. I think it's notable because of these people who fled the militants or the fighting, they fled to safety, what they thought was safety. They've been living in uncomfortable circumstances, very crowded. And even then, this building was attacked 2 or 3 days prior to me visiting there, which is another reason I wanted to visit, to hear what had happened. And a rocket of some sort was fired at, you can see in the upper right-hand corner, at this room, and 4 people from one family were killed. But the issue of internal refugees is, I think, very important and overlooked in the media. There's a lot of talk about external refugees, and there should be. But the issue of somewhere between 7 or 8 million internal refugees is completely overlooked, unless I've been missing something in the corporate media. And it is important because these people have fled areas where there's fighting, where there are militants present, and they've gone to government areas. And if the narrative that people are fleeing the government is true, then why do they run into the hands of the government, knowing that they're going to be massacred by the government? This is, again, not to say that civilians aren't being killed in Syria, but you have to think in the context of a war, civilians will die, and that Syria is fighting terrorism. And if we do not acknowledge this is terrorism, when we have al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda, when we have ISIS, of course, when we have Nur ad-Din al-Zinki, which gleefully beheaded a 12 or 13-year-old Palestinian child, took a video of themselves doing so and took selfies of themselves doing so, and are still dubbed moderates. When we have Ahrar al-Sham, which are dubbed moderates, but in U.S.-owned internal documents, Congressional Research Service documents, they're dubbed as terrorists. In any case, when you have militants or terrorist mercenaries that have flooded into Syria, largely through Turkey, through the open border and thanks to Erdogan, flooding Syria in the name of waging jihad for Palestine, some of them actually are, a small percentage, or overthrowing the government. I lost my train of thought. Anyway, the whole point is that these are acts of terrorism. And I've forgotten your name, who introduced me and was speaking about Yemen and their legitimate right to resist a blockade. Syria is a sovereign country and has a legitimate right to resist terrorism. This is another image from Aleppo. This was from Castella Road. And Castella Road was one of 8 humanitarian corridors that were opened in the hopes of allowing civilians to leave areas where militants were. On November 4th, this delegation of journalists that I joined to go to Aleppo on that occasion, we went to two crossings, one of them being Castella Road, and we were there for a couple of hours. And during the time we were there, at the end, before leaving, there were two shells fired on the crossing from an area occupied by militants. And this is not the first time they've attacked crossings. In late October, a friend of mine, a British man married to a Syrian living in Damascus, but also working on trying to report truth from Syria, he was at another crossing, Bustan al-Qasr, I think it was around October 20th, there a couple days before or after. And he said from the morning till evening, that crossing was shelled by militants who clearly didn't want people to have the option of leaving East Aleppo to government-secured Aleppo. On a side note, this man, he, his wife and children, and about 40 other Syrians in late October did flee East Aleppo. He was from a district called Al-Halaq, which was north of an area called Bustan al-Pasha. And he said they took advantage of a time when there was fighting between the government and militants or rebels in that area. And he made the point, we tried to leave before. He and his family tried to leave twice before and were prevented by the militants who kept them there. Violently prevented. He was arrested the first time he tried and told, if you do this again, we're going to do worse to you. I interviewed one other family from Tariq al-Bab, and they had tried four times prior to flee and were also prevented. And this is notable. There are many testimonies. Yes, you might need to look at Russia Today or Sputnik or independents like Vanessa Bealey on 21st Century Wire or Reverend Andrew Ashdown or Jan Oberg, who went to Aleppo in December when it was being liberated. There are many people who have collected similar testimonies, and more recently, and from liberated areas of Aleppo, where people said, we were being held hostage. That's not to say every single person, but a great number of people were trying to leave and could not leave. And the logical reason being, if the civilians were taken out of these areas, then it's a lot easier for the Syrian army and allies to wage attacks on terrorists. If the civilians are there, it's more difficult because to avoid loss of life. He said some other interesting things about life there. He said terrorists or militants occupied hospitals and schools and made them into headquarters. He saw militant factions coming out with their hell cannons, which were these large cannons used to fire the cooking gas canister bombs onto Aleppo, and then saw them scurry below ground into bunkers, meaning that when, whether it was the Russians or the Syrian government did airstrike or try to bomb areas where there are militants, it is difficult because they're underground. And that would explain a lot of the physical destruction you'll see in areas like East Aleppo or Homs Prior. And none of that context is really given in corporate media. They just talk about bombing with no context as to what's being targeted. The family, this one I said, were from Tariq al-Bab, and I did ask people I met in Aleppo whether they'd heard of the White Helmets or also Syrian Civil Defense as they go by. And most people I met had not, including people in the medical profession. And this family from Tariq al-Bab said they had not. And yet this is a photo also purporting to be Tariq al-Bab. So it's probably a large district. It is feasible that the family just never encountered them. It's also feasible that maybe they're not as legendary as they make themselves out to be, the White Helmets. A woman I encountered on the campus of these of Aleppo University, this is not staged. She basically came up to me, was happy to see a foreigner. I should rephrase that, happy to see a foreigner that was not holding a weapon. And she started speaking to me in very good English, so I said, can I film you so that people outside of Syria can hear what you have to say? So she spoke from the heart, and I think her message saying, you know, she recognizes that, of course, not every militant is foreigner, but a large number of them are foreigners, and there is a foreign agenda to destabilize Syria, to push Syrians out of Syria, for example, especially Christians. I don't know if you're aware, but in the very early protests, amongst the chants for freedom and democracy were also chants to kill Alawis and drive Christians out of Syria. And this was something that was heard throughout Syria. And I've had numerous accounts, whether it was people I met in Latakia in April 2014, people I met on repeated trips to Homs, people I met in Damascus, in Maalula, all over. In Maalula, there weren't protests, but they certainly suffered sectarianism. And I'd like to actually just briefly touch on Maalula. Maalula is an ancient Christian village, Aramaic. It's one of the oldest, apparently, in history. A beautiful village nestled in the cliffs, at the base of the cliffs. And it was occupied in, I believe it was September 2013, not only by al-Nusra, but also by the Free Syrian Army. and it was occupied for about 8 months. There were skirmishes back and forth, but it was fully occupied, and it wasn't liberated till April 2014. And I visited there in June 2014, and then again this past summer. And when I visited in June, I saw a lot of the destruction of these historic churches and monasteries. What couldn't be thieved or shot down was vandalized in other ways. Material icons were stabbed, were torn apart. It was a deliberate attack on the Christians there. But in the visit in the summer, I spoke with a woman named Antoinette Talib, and her brother, uncle, and cousin were assassinated because they refused to convert to Islam. And I just want to specify, I don't believe that these al-Nusra, ISIS, or other Wahhabi or Muslim Brotherhood are acting upon the tenets of Islam. I believe they have extremist ideologies. Anyway, these people were told to convert. They said, no, we were born Christian, we'll die Christian, and they did die Christian. They were assassinated. This was 2014. These were the rebels bringing democracy and freedom to Syria. If you saw any images coming out of Aleppo in December when it was being liberated, depending on which media you were looking at, you were either seeing mass groups of people basically cheering and waving Syrian flags and saying, thank God, the reign of terror is over, essentially. Or if you were watching corporate media, you were seeing scenes where people were saying Aleppo has fallen and totally ignoring the suffering they'd been enduring for years. And corporate media did have access to Aleppo. When I was there in July, Robert Fisk was there. He's been pretty good on reporting fairly truthfully. When I was there in November, CBC was there. There was a group of three or so CBC reporters. I've been quite busy since, so I don't know how they portrayed things, but I suspect it was the opposite of truth. Channel 4 was there. And I'm aware that even Vice News, which is not really known for being impartial reporting, it's one of the more sleazy sites, they have been in Aleppo. So just to say, this whole notion that they couldn't report the truth because they couldn't get there is patently false. Another point I want to make very quickly. You can see there's a Reverend Ibrahim Nasir. He's a Presbyterian priest. And then three Sunni leaders. Aleppo is predominantly Sunni city. In our media, we're told what's happening in Syria is a Sunni uprising against Alawis and other kind of sectarian language. In my experiences, and this is corroborated by other visitors to Syria, it's a very secular country. And Stephen Gowans writes extensively about how how the Syrian secularity has been a stable of society there. But when I've been there and spoken with people, they do not identify as their faith. They identify as Syrians, and it's very difficult to get them to say what faith they are because it's their business. So they're not in the business of chastising one another based on their faith. To the contrary, they actually share one another's, this is generalizing, but it's what I've seen throughout Syria and being told, they share one another's faiths, and there's intermarrying. I have a couple of friends, one is Sunni, one is Shia, they've married. That's one example, of course, and I encourage you to look at for more other examples because there are many. But in this instance, Reverend Ibrahim said his church was destroyed. I forget what year. It was bombed by terrorists, intentionally destroying it. It was in the old city of Aleppo. He said right after it was destroyed, Syria's Grand Mufti, so the highest religious leader for Muslims in Syria, called him and said, don't worry, Reverend Ibrahim, we'll rebuild the church. And he also this is with the delegation of foreign journalists. And we met with him and these three Sunni leaders. The one looking pretty snazzy in a suit was from East Aleppo, and he said he was driven out of the area by militants who put him on a death list because from his mosque there were no sectarian protests emanating. He didn't buy into the revolution, and he certainly didn't buy into sectarianism. And so to punish him, the militants either wanted him to conform and start, having these sectarian protests or kill him. So what I actually just wanted to show you before wrapping up, there is a priest named Father Daniel, and he's been in a monastery. Now, I wish I had the screenshots because I can't remember the name of the monastery, but I can certainly provide it to you. And he basically said the same thing as Father Franz van der Loot, who was a priest that was in Old Homs, who was assassinated in April 2014 by militants. And both of them said from the beginning they saw protesters who had arms and that were firing upon security forces. These are priests. I don't know about Father Daniel, but I know Father Franz wasn't a government supporter. He was a priest living there for decades, and he was just reporting and writing about what he was seeing in Homs. and he was assassinated eventually. So there are many accounts. Again, when I've been there and talked with people, I've met many Syrians who've said, when the protests began, we were optimistic because we want political change, but very quickly we saw that there were armed segments within the protesters. And on my last visit, I interviewed somebody who was a soldier stationed in Dara, which is said to be the birthplace of the revolution. And he himself came under fire by people who were armed in the protests, killing the police and soldiers who were unarmed, only with batons. This runs, of course, in contrast to the Western narrative on Syria. I refer you humbly to an article I wrote, mainly just because I do cite a lot of very credible sources in the article. It's on Dissident Voice. I called it Deconstructing the NATO Narrative on Syria. I looked at some of the key myths or the key things we've been told about Syria, and then I, whether it was support for the government or the nonviolent protests, and then I linked to people who've done really important research and writings on it. One I would really highly recommend is Sharmeen Narwani. Now, again, she has contributed to RT, but she's also written for the Huffington Post, so, you know, you can argue it either way. She wrote this excellent article, Syria, the Hidden Massacre, and it should be plural because she wrote about a number of massacres that occurred in the early months by people who were clearly armed. There was the case of, I think his name was Ali Hashim, Ali Hashim maybe? He was an Al Jazeera reporter who resigned when Al Jazeera wouldn't run the footage he had taken showing militants entering Syria from Lebanon in May 2011. This was at a time when, again, the narrative was unarmed protesters, and it was clearly showing that these people were being sent into Syria as fighters. And he was told to forget that he'd seen any armed men. And there are many cases of journalists, including more journalists in Al Jazeera, resigning due to what they saw were media lies about Syria. I guess what I'd like to leave you with, there's a lot we can say, but I know you have some questions. I would recommend some writings like Seymour Hersh, who can no longer, to my knowledge, be published in America. He's published in the London Review of Books. He's done excellent investigative journalism, whether it's about the chemical weapons allegations. He's traced, you know, the sarin back to the so-called rebels and, you know, looked at who was providing the sarin gas to the rebels. Tim Anderson, as I mentioned, Sharmeen Narwani, and other people of 21st Century Wire who've either gone to Syria or extensively researched. I look at a variety of sources, and whether I look at Sputnik or RT, I always corroborate it with other sources because I want to be sure that what I'm seeing has substance to it. And I'd encourage you to do that with what I've talked about. I didn't talk about how I got into this all, and I won't dwell too long on it, but basically I got into writing from Palestine out of genuine interest in seeing what the people were suffering under Israeli occupation and attacks. And I started a simple blog called In Gaza, because for me the point was to report on what I was seeing, not about myself. And over time I started, you can see some of the places I write for. There's a long list, including Russia Today, but also Mint Press News and a number of others. And when things started in Syria, I fully admit I knew nothing about Syria, and I still have a lot to learn, but I suspected what I was seeing on Al Jazeera, which is what a lot of people in Gaza do watch, by the way, which is Qatari-owned. So if we're going to talk about state-funded, you have to know the source behind the Al Jazeera propaganda. I started feeling like what I was seeing wasn't accurate. It seems strange. And I started asking people whose opinions I respected and then doing my own research. And as the years passed, finally felt I was informed enough to actually go to Syria and then talk with Syrians. And then that's kind of been the evolution. My sole interest is in respecting the people of Syria, their sovereign right to fight terrorism, and to get peace again. I think many people aren't aware there have been many initiatives. You know, in addition to these humanitarian corridors, which some would argue, well, that's just stage, you know, it's just to make it seem like the government wants to find peace. There are reconciliation efforts that nobody speaks about, giving Syrian fighters the chance to lay down their weapons, be completely pardoned, rejoin society. And there are many Syrians that, for whatever reason, who took up arms in the beginning, regret their choice and want to find a way out. There are also Syrians, I'm told, and again, please corroborate this, that were coerced by militant factions to take up weapons and fight, or else their families, for example, might be killed or something horrible like that. I'd like to just share one more example before closing. There was a sheikh, a leader of a large tribe in eastern Aleppo, or eastern Syrian Deir ez-Zor, Sheikh Nawaf al-Bashir, who defected or fled from Syria in, I don't know, 2011 or 12, but pretty early on. He's recently returned to Syria. When he was away in Turkey, and I'm not sure where else, he said some pretty bad things about Syria, about the government, about what was happening. And certainly you would expect that he would not be welcomed, because this is also the other line, is that dissenters can't be in Syria. There is an unarmed political opposition in Syria with a variety of different backgrounds, whether communist, feminist, Kurdish, or other parties. But this man who said some, you know, things that perhaps if he were in America and did that and then returned, he might be thrown in jail. He's returned to Syria. He actually gave a speech saying he regrets his ways. He made the wrong decision, and he's now back in Syria. And he's not, to my knowledge, in prison. So I think it's important to recognize there are internal opposition members, but the opposition the West has been supporting are Saudi-backed. One is the brother of Zahran Alush, who is known for putting civilians in cages and using them as human shields. And others adhere to a very extremist Wahhabi ideology. And again, in terms of bringing Syria freedom and democracy, just look at the militants that were in Aleppo. Look at the photos of how women were being treated in Aleppo. Testimonies of women being saying they were being forced to marry militants, and you know, awful things happening to them. And look at Syria prior to 2011. And really, most Syrians I've met had said, we just want Syria to go back to how it was before. We had stability. Of course, they have free education and health care. It wasn't a perfect country. They want political changes. But certainly, the options that have been presented to them by the West, determining for them who will lead their country, these options have not been fair or certainly not been democratic and given them any freedom. And finally, just consider who the West's allies are in this war on Syria. Saudi Arabia certainly can't be said, although it holds a position in the United Nations, bizarrely, as on the Human Rights Council, it can't be said to have a good record on human rights. And yet that's one of our Canada and America's closest allies, Qatar, Turkey. I would encourage you to read the writings of Michel Chusadovsky, Tim Anderson, who provide a lot more context into how this came about. But clearly, in my opinion, and that of many others, this is not about giving peace to Syria or giving people democracy and freedom. So thank you very much. There might be an announcement, or else it's question and answers.
That was Canadian journalist Ava Bartlett presenting at Winnipeg's Millennium Library on February 2, 2017, on her reporting in Syria. The talk was followed by a brief question and answer period.
There are many instances of massacres committed by whether it was the Free Syrian Army, Ahrar al-Sham, or other moderates. Uncritical support. Again, I stated very clearly, I'm against a premeditated war of which there is ample documentation. I would highly recommend people, if they don't want to buy The Dirty War on Syria, which is available on globalresearch.ca, you can find a lot of Tim Anderson's writings on global research. He's one person, but what he writes corroborates what I've heard in person by Syrians in Syria. And again, some of the other authors I've mentioned. In my humble opinion, Syrians in Syria do have grievances against the government, and there are issues of torture, and there are issues of it being very authoritarian, but there are other contextual issues that some people don't seem to recognize or address. On that note, I would recommend highly people take a read of Stephen Gowan's this article, The Revolutionary Distemper That Wasn't. It's a bit long, it's very detailed, very well documented, it gives the context which was not given in your question, and also which is not given in the corporate media. Russian army involvement. The Russians were invited to fight terrorism in Syria in, I believe it was late September 2015, and they have been enabling the Syrian army and allies to take back strategic areas, including the historic area of Palmyra, which was occupied by ISIS. The U.S. Coalition, which is supposedly fighting ISIS, enabled ISIS trucks to cross hundreds of miles of open desert to take Palmyra. It kind of baffles the mind to think that with all their high-tech technology, they somehow missed a convoy of ISIS SUVs or Ford pickup trucks or whatever they were barreling through the desert and didn't stop them. The U.S.-led coalition attacked a Syrian army position in Deir ez-Zor on September 17th, killing at least 80 Syrian soldiers, could be over 100. I've heard different estimates. In an attack that was not just one attack, but a prolonged attack lasting nearly 1 hour, They had been surveying the area. They knew it was a Syrian army position. They attacked it nonetheless, attacking, including retreating Syrian army soldiers, and immediately following, ISIS took over that position. So in terms of the Russian involvement, it was invited by the government. The U.S. coalition was not invited. They're actually, their presence there is illegal, and they've repeatedly attacked infrastructure, like, for example, bridges in Deir ez-Zor, and they've committed massacres of their own right against civilians in Syria. Militants versus rebels, it's my attempt to find, I hate the word moderate, middle ground between saying terrorist, which is what most Syrians I've met call them. But when you say that here, you know, it has an impact on a Western audience and people think it's not credible. However, I refuse to use rebels because the acts that they are committing are not acts that true rebels would do, unless I'm continually using quotation marks when I say rebels. So the middle ground I've been using is militants, but that's to answer your question. It doesn't really necessarily imply the organizational structure. It's just trying to find a middle ground. Premeditated war, I was trying to pull it up, but for some reason it wouldn't load. However, there is the Project for New American Century document, which does outline... It does outline Western aspirations in the Middle East. And as we were talking about this afternoon, you have the famous General Wesley Clark statement saying the Pentagon had informed him, you know, high ups in the Pentagon had informed him, this is back in 2004 or somewhere around there, that the U.S. was going to wage war on seven countries, and including Syria, Yemen, Libya, et cetera. So there's much documentation. Even the Oded Yenen plan, the Greater Israel Project, is very relevant to this situation. And as far as the Arab League, I can't really speak much to it. I would recommend Shermeen Narwani, because I'm pretty sure she's written something about the role of the Arab League. I would say something about the role of the UN, and that's been largely to obfuscate the realities. For example, the UN does have observer forces in the occupied Syrian Golan who have observed and documented militants interacting with Israeli army, Israeli soldiers. They've documented it and they've presented this at the UN to deaf ears. You would think the fact that Israel is not only dealing with militants in occupied Syrian Golan, but also treating them in their hospitals would be a point that would come up more and more in the United Nations. But it's been a player in the role, in the game of you know, confusing people and obfuscating truth on Syria.
You just heard audio from a talk by Ava Bartlett on what is really going on in Syria. Since Bartlett's visit to Winnipeg, Syrian forces, with the assistance of the Russian Air Force, have made substantial advances against the opposition forces and have liberated a number of other terrorist-controlled cities inside Syria. The U.S. has agreed to arm the YPG, Kurdish Popular Protection Units, which fight alongside the so-called opposition Syrian Democratic Forces. U.S. President Trump said the CIA would no longer arm the so-called moderate rebels battling the government of President Bashar al-Assad. And in early July, U.S. President Trump and Russian President Putin announced a ceasefire agreement for the southwest of the country, which is held as of early August. Ava Bartlett has returned to Syria for the seventh time to provide more coverage. An archive of her past and recent writings on Syria can be found on her website, ingaza.wordpress.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our program every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download our podcasts from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Music this week was by Purple Planet Music. More selections are available at the site www.purple-planet.com. The show resumes next week with more special summer programming. My name is Michael Welch.